Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to see you. Thanks, everyone, for coming out on this beautiful, luminous fall day. It's just great to see you all. So, my talk today is about delusion and acknowledging the extent to which we can be deluded and having respect for the fact that we have this capacity for delusion. Another way to say this, a more positive way, I think, is that we can respect the mystery in our lives and know that we don't have all the answers and be comfortable with that knowledge. We can embrace not knowing. And my talk is also about right action, about doing the right thing in the world. I was drawn to talk about these two things because these are two ideas, and they're both basic to Zen, that seem a little contradictory. Right action and not knowing. Right action is consistent with the Bodhisattva ideal of Mahayana Buddhism. There is no question that Zen is about acting in the world, not withdrawing from the world. Not knowing is also essential to Zen. If you doubt that, read Dogen and try to come away with a few neat bullet points. If we don't know how things are for sure, how can we act in the world? That contradiction is captured, I think, in the Bodhisattva vows. Delusions are inexhaustible, vowing to extinguish them. If delusions are inexhaustible, how can I possibly know which ones are delusions, much less extinguish them? How can I engage in right action if I can't be confident that I know the right way to act? How can I be comfortable standing on the shifting sands of not knowing? How can I be in the world that, for all I know, isn't even the world? So part one of this talk is going to be about delusions are inexhaustible. Part two will be about right action, which is vowing to do something about that. And I'll explore that by looking at one particular realm of human activity, something that's been on all of our minds quite a lot these days. So to begin to talk about delusion, about the remarkable extent to which we can be deluded, if you're not convinced of that already, through your own experience, I'm going to tell you a story. This is a story about my wife, Kathy, and I. Like most people, we like to watch movies now and then. And we're always on the lookout for new types of movies that we haven't been exposed to before. We like to broaden our horizons a little bit. We ask people for suggestions. Sometimes we'll look at critics' lists of the best movies. And we came across a list of the best 100 films of the 21st century, according to 177 film critics around the world. Pretty impressive. So that's the best 100 movies of the last 16 years. So I thought, well, maybe we've missed something good. We'll check it out. And the number one movie of the last 16 years, according to 177 critics, was, to our surprise, something called Mulholland Drive, a 2001 movie by David Lynch. How many of you have seen that movie? Okay, a few, not too many. So neither of us had seen it, and we didn't know anything about it. We knew who David Lynch was. He's been around a long time. He did Elephant Man, which I really liked. He did Dune, which I really did not like. He did Blue Velvet, which I didn't like, and he did Twin Peaks, which wasn't really my thing, but it was pretty intriguing, and I watched a few episodes. So we decided to give it a try. So there we were in our little front room where our TV is, and Kathy called it up on her computer through some service or other where she gets movies in order to show it on the TV. So it was running on the TV and on her computer simultaneously. But we were basically watching the TV because it's a bigger screen. And the first thing I noticed about this movie was that it began with music, with a complete song, which ran over the credits, I think, which is not unusual at all for a movie. But it seems slightly odd that when that first song ended, a second one immediately began, and it played through until the end. And then a third one after that. And then the characters began to appear, and we could hear the dialogue in the movie just a little bit underneath the music, or when the music became quieter, or between songs, we could hear the dialogue a little bit. So I was watching the characters interact, and I could see that they were talking to each other, but I didn't really know what they were saying, and I thought, this is interesting. And a fourth song started, and a fifth, and I realized, wow, I believe this entire movie is going to consist of complete songs, one after the other, as we watch these characters. And so apparently the director has set it up so that the dialogue doesn't really matter. It's a different kind of movie experience. And the movie was odd in other ways as well. There were odd characters, kind of jumpy action, things that appeared but obviously were not easily explained. And so the part about not needing the dialogue didn't seem all that strange. And this is David Lynch, the Twin Peaks guy, and he's unusual. Okay, I'm open to this. And so, wow, this is a new kind of movie. This is something that's never been done before. The action takes place to music, and there's a lot that you don't understand, so maybe you're losing something there, but you're gaining something too, because there's this interaction between the music and the action that kind of gives you a new way to experience reality. Okay, so if it's the best movie of the 21st century so far, one would expect it to be a little different, right? So there were the characters and the darkness and the weirdness, and that didn't do too much for me. It was kind of like watching Twin Peaks some more. It wasn't that great, but I was really enjoying the music. And the music, one of the first songs I said to Kathy, hey, that's LCD Sound System. Remember them? They opened for Arcade Fire when we saw them in St. Paul. And we were, by the way, the oldest people in the room among 8,000 people. And I was familiar with a lot of the music. There was even a song by The Band, which is like my all-time favorite rock band. There was some Bob Dylan, there was some folky stuff, and I thought, wow, that David Lynch really has good taste in music. And you know, it makes sense. He's not that far from my age. It makes sense that we might kind of like the same stuff. And then toward the end of the movie, Kath said about one of the songs, you know, that was on my old playlist. Well, okay. And then she said, that was on my playlist too. And a little part of me is saying, well, that's kind of confusing, but I'm getting really tired now, and I just don't really want to take that in, okay? So I'm like, don't confuse my life, okay? And maybe you know where I'm going now. Especially if you've seen the movie. So we got to the end, and I was barely awake, and the ending credits started to come up, and I said, wait a minute, don't turn it off. I want to see who did all of these songs, because there were a few I didn't recognize. And we got to the music credits, and there were only about 6 songs listed. Where are all of my songs? And then the credits ended, and then the music continued. And Kathy said, that was my playlist. No, I mean, really, that was my playlist. And, oh my God, I got it. I got it. Somehow, when she set up her computer to show the movie, she had opened up her iTunes. And it had started playing her playlist. And it played simultaneously with the movie. And it happened that the volume on her playlist was loud, and the volume on the movie was really low. And it was an old playlist, and she hadn't really played it in a long time, so it wasn't that familiar to her anymore. So, wow. So Mulholland Drive is an ordinary movie. It has this dialogue that you're supposed to hear like any other movie. And that music was our music, totally selected by us. And we watched that entire movie thinking that our music was really the movie's music. Wow. Now, you could say that we accidentally created a new work of art that went beyond anything the director did, and that it was really enriching. And that would be a very positive spin. And there might be something to that, but that's not where I'm going to today. I want to talk about how wrong I was. I want to talk about delusion. So we'll leave that idea that it could have been a happy accident for another day. So my first reaction was profound embarrassment, and I still feel that. And I can't believe I'm even telling you about this. Because I consider myself a pretty intelligent person. True, I don't know much about computers or technology or audio or how things can play simultaneously, but I'm not an idiot. But I can't believe the depth of my delusion on this occasion. And there were all of these signs I should have picked up. There was one point in the movie where someone on screen was singing a song, and yet there was another song over them. And I'm like, okay, David Lynch, strange guy. 177 critics, what do I know? But I'm telling you about this because I think I learned something from this, which was really quite interesting. And I feel like that little episode, that little situation, is a pretty good metaphor for how we misperceive the world. Actually, it's more like an allegory than a metaphor because it went on and on. So we humans, as you know, come from a place of ego, and we have a self-centered way of looking at things. We have preferences, and they tend to cloud our judgment. And we are hardwired, as Wayne said a few weeks back in his Dharma talk, we are hardwired biologically to live in delusion. And you can say that delusion is useful and necessary, and that's true. And you can say that delusion is not that much different from a working theory, but that's for another talk. This idea of delusion, I think, is connected to something very basic to Buddhism, which is the second noble truth. The first noble truth is that we suffer. There is suffering. The second noble truth is that we suffer because we desire. And our desires have something to do with the way we see. Our desires to have the world be just the way we want it to be, those desires prevent us from seeing the world as it really is. We are overlaying our own preferences upon reality. For example, I may really want everything to be beautiful and smooth, and when it's not, I deny that there's a problem because I don't want to have a problem. And so I don't do anything about the real problem that is there. I'm in denial. And that causes suffering. An example, I suspect my child or my teenager is getting into some really scary stuff. And I say, no, not my kid. It couldn't be my kid. It couldn't happen. And so I ignore something that I should be paying attention to. But there's also the third noble truth. I can end the suffering by ending the desire. I give up my need for things to be a certain way, and I see clearly. I see that I've been ignoring something that I should pay attention to. And I talk to my teen about it, and I reflect on my ability to delude myself, and I learn something, and I start over. And this movie incident, I think, is just a great representation of how we can go through life deluded. I'm going to assume the existence of an objective reality here, okay? And I'm going to say that there is a ground of reality the way things really are, represented here by the movie. There's an actual movie there, made by an actual guy. And that movie has nothing to do with me or my desires. But I was able, somehow, to watch that entire movie while missing what the director intended, missing what the movie really was, and substituting for that reality something which was actually my own personal view of reality, represented by the playlist, our favorite songs. And I was thinking that I was confusing my favorite stuff with reality. It was a complete overlay upon reality of my personal preferences. And I didn't question it for the longest time. And I liked it. And I discarded mounting evidence to the contrary. So after I realized that, I was thinking, wow, when else has this happened? What other massive delusions are going on in my life? And I think this puts me in the same league as, you remember that old cartoon character, Mr. Magoo? long time ago. This was a guy, he's a cartoon. He's really kind of an annoying guy, but it was an interesting premise in the cartoon. He really couldn't see. His vision was terrible, but he didn't know that. And he thought he was seeing things he wasn't doing. And he would go with his nephew Waldo somewhere, and he'd be totally deluded about where he was. And if I remember correctly, one time he thought he was going to a football game, but he actually was at a construction site. And everything he saw, he would kind of work into his version of reality. And he saw bulldozers, and he thought they were linebackers. And every single thing he meets, he has an explanation for. He incorporates it into his mistaken view of reality. And that was the joke in every cartoon. The amazing extent to which he could reconcile this contradictory information with his preconceived idea of reality. But the most amazing thing about this movie incident, I think, was this. There were a number of times during the movie when I was so moved by the way the music and the action on the screen came together. I mean, there were times when the music kind of came to an emotional turning point and something was happening on the screen too, and I went, wow, that was really good. How did he do that? Did he choose the music and then film the stuff to fit the music, or was it the other way around? But I was thinking, this is this new art form. I like it. There's a lot of value in it. And of course, those things were completely random. There was no actual correlation. So I derived from this folly a rule. If you create an overlay of delusion, there will be moments of coincidence that seem to confirm your delusion. It's almost guaranteed. And that had never been so clearly demonstrated to me before. So if you only pay attention to those certain moments and you kind of discount those other moments, you're going to get your view of reality confirmed. And it's going to be really easy to get off track there. And I can think of lots of examples about how this may work. One I'm familiar with, reading the daily astrology predictions in the newspaper. I used to do that quite a lot. And I'm not putting down astrology because there are a lot of things that science doesn't understand. And a lot of people have paid attention to it for a long time. And there may be something useful there. But if you read your little forecast in the newspaper every day, it's virtually guaranteed that there are going to be a few times during the year when it's going to fit so beautifully with what actually happened that you're going to say, yeah, that's right. There's really something to this astrology stuff. The random stuff is going to happen. But I think you have to ask yourself, what if you had chosen one of the other 12 signs and you had read that all year? Those same coincidences might have happened. I think if you believe that people are basically good, you're going to constantly find confirmations for that. If you believe people are basically bad, the same thing is going to happen. If you decide there is an international conspiracy of this or that, you're going to find some confirmation now and then. If you gamble, you're going to win sometimes, and you're going to think this gambling thing works pretty well, if you don't think about all the times you lost as well. If you engage in any ritual hoping for a certain result, sometimes that result is going to occur. And you have to ask, could it be a coincidence? And one place where extended delusions operate a lot, I think, is in the political realm. Yeah, because it's on everybody's minds, right? And it's a little stressful right now. So I'm glad I have an opportunity to bring it up. But I know this about delusions operating in the political realm because I think I've engaged in them myself. I think not to a ridiculous extreme, but to the point where at some point I kind of corrected myself and went, wait a minute, you're not seeing the whole picture there. There's some information that just came in that you were really uncomfortable with, and you wanted to just discard that information. So some of us have a tendency, I think, to identify the enemy and starkly delineate good versus bad. and then see all of the details in the political world in terms of how they support our view, and continually seek facts that support that view and avoid the facts that don't support that view. I mean, that's a human tendency. Everybody does it, I think, to some degree now and then. And we see this on both the left and the right. And I think there are certain people whom we may largely ignore because we know that they have taken a position and all they are ever going to present to us is the stuff that fits their position. And they are never going to talk about the countervailing concerns or evidence or present them in an honest way. They're here to convince us to take action in accordance with their view. They're not here to find the truth. And there's a fundamental dishonesty in that kind of unwillingness to deal with the information that doesn't support their view. So I think I've established pretty thoroughly that delusions are inexhaustible. The second part of this talk is about vowing to extinguish them. Vowing to do something is about right action. Right action is one step of the Eightfold Path, which is the fourth noble truth. We must do the right thing. What is the right thing? Well, I think it's the compassionate thing. What is the compassionate thing? Well, it's not always easy to know. As I asked in the beginning, if we know that we can be easily deluded, how can we do anything at all? How can we possibly know what the right thing is? That's my question today. Well, I think of it this way. I think that the proper response to knowing that we are easily deluded, to knowing that we can make mistakes, and knowing that we still need to act in the world, is to embrace not knowing. And not knowing in Zen, as you know, if you've been around here very much, is a positive thing. Not knowing is the ability to say, I know there are limits to what human beings can understand, and I respect that, and I can act in the world in a way that respects that. I won't act as if I'm certain when I'm not. I will be intellectually honest about what I don't know. I'll constantly check my opinions against the opinions of others, and I will welcome those opinions, and I won't shut them out. And I will value those friends and those teachers who challenge me. I will walk carefully on the earth, knowing that I cannot be sure what kind of damage I'll do if I walk aggressively. And another way of talking about this, which I really like, is to go even a bit beyond not knowing and talk about respecting the mystery. Respecting the mystery. Someone who writes very nicely about this is Krista Tippett in her book, Becoming Wise. It's a good book. I really like this. Kathy and I read it aloud to each other. It's not a Buddhist book, but that's fine because respect for the mystery is something that is not unique to Buddhism. And I think Krista believes that it is something that all religions share, although all religions are capable of getting off track about it too. And so she has this chapter on faith, Faith the Evolution. She says, faith is evolutionary in every culture and in any life. Even a person who could proclaim all of their days, I believe in God, or I trust in prayer, would fill those words with endlessly transforming memories, experiences, and connotations. The same enduring fundamental belief will hold a transfigured substance in the beginning, the middle, and the end of one lifetime. Views keep changing. They keep changing. Wisdom of the everyday sort is about how we reckon with the surprises and mysteries that make life life as opposed to stasis. So wisdom is about how we reckon with the surprises and mysteries of life. Wisdom is about what we don't know as much as, or maybe more than, what we do know. Mystery lands in us as a humbling fullness of reality we cannot sum up or pin down. Such moments change us from the inside if we let them. I think that's beautiful. She talks, she quotes a person named Robert Coles, who quotes the writer Flannery O'Connor, who said, "The task of the novelist is to deepen mystery." And then she pauses and says, "But mystery is a great embarrassment to the modern mind. And there's our tragedy, that we have to resolve all mystery. We can't let it be. We can't rejoice in it. We can't celebrate it. We can't affirm it as an aspect of our lives. Because, after all, mystery is an aspect of our lives. And mystery, you bet. Mystery is a great challenge. It's an invitation, and it's a wonderful companion, actually." So how do we act in the face of mystery? We engage in actions that take into account the limitations of science and human knowledge. One way to think about this, when we think about the Earth, is we treat the Earth as sacred because we know we can't understand which things on it are important. All things are interrelated, but we know that we lack the capacity to see all of these interrelationships. So we'd better be pretty careful. Which things we're doing on the earth right now might be our undoing? Well, we really can't be sure. It's an important question. We might have asked ourselves this in, say, 1950. Is it the extinction of a species that really matters? If so, which one? Is it a failure to conserve the soil? Is it burning fossil fuels? It could be, but we don't know, not in 1950. So we'd best be humble and treat all the earth as sacred. This is a deep value in Native American spirituality, and it could save us if we would open ourselves to it. And I think when it comes to the distribution of resources, there is another thing we can treat as sacred. And that is, we can say we will not make decisions whose primary negative impact will be on the most vulnerable people in our society. We just don't do that. And I'd like to think that there is something in Zen that incorporates mystery as well, that respects what we don't know. I think that occurs through our ability to constantly deconstruct our own belief systems. The Heart Sutra takes all of the basic doctrines of the Buddha one by one and says that they do not exist. And that's our most basic chant. I love that about Buddhism. And we say, if you see the Buddha coming down the road, kill him. We say that. That's pretty radical. And Manjushri has his sword that cuts through delusion. And one delusion he cuts through is that he has his sword, which cuts through delusion. So for the last bit of my talk here, I'd like to return to the political realm a bit and talk about how this plays out, this respect for not knowing in that practical area of human endeavor. But with the election coming up and things being the way they are, I'd like to take a moment to recognize that this has been a pretty stressful time for a lot of us. And I think right action has not been easy. We may find a little more anger or conflict in our lives. We may find ourselves arguing with people in ways that doesn't really feel very good. We may have a lot of fears. We may have the urge to just tune out. And I think everybody just wants it to be over. And I understand this stress, and I feel it myself. Those who are active in electoral politics have a special kind of stress. But there's a lot of stress involved in just reading the news, just following it day to day. And I think it's hard for some people not to become a little obsessed with things like electoral maps and the most recent revelations and things like that. And this is a great opportunity for monkey mind to come in and start running the show. I feel that too. I get in my car and I want to turn on the news right away. And what I'd like to say about this is, if you find yourself getting seriously stressed out, it's okay to take a step back. And it might be the best thing to say, well, for this day, I'm just not going to read the news. or at least for the next 2 hours, I'm not going to read the news. I'm going to take a break. But given our commitment to right action, I think it's not okay to step back to the point where you say, I'm not going to participate. I mean, unless the stress is really a threat to your well-being, I do think right action requires us to participate in the world, particularly during difficult times. And there are a lot of things we can do. We can act. Active campaigning is great. And I would urge everyone to vote, regardless of who your candidate is. And get your, if your kids are old enough to vote, get them to vote. Get your parents to vote. Get your grandparents to vote. Give them a ride to the polls. This is important stuff. And the other big thing regarding right action, and this is something I think that Buddhists can really contribute to, is to not give in to the hatred and the incivility and the rigidity of view. Because in times like this, we can feel ourselves hardening, because everybody's hardening a little bit. And in times like this, an act of unhardening, I think, can make a real difference. And we can do this by bringing in respect and by bringing in not knowing, by being open to the idea that I don't have all the answers, that I can really listen to others and not simply reject them because their view is different from mine. Not starting out with, well, you're wrong and here's why, but starting out with, well, why do you think that? Tell me more. I would really like to understand. And this has to start with us. We can't say, well, they started it, so I'm going to respond in kind. The cycle has to be broken by someone who says, I'm not playing that game right now. The Dhammapada says, for hatred does not cease by hatred at any time. Hatred ceases by love. This is an unending truth. So I think it's good to really listen, to talk to people with opposing views. Excuse me. And this is something I've talked about in other talks. I did a talk about my experience years ago during the Vietnam War and how it's taken me really about 40 years to reconcile some things that happened back then and really listen to the other side, to what I perceived as the other side and what now I now see as not another side, but just part of the whole thing. And not long ago, I talked about police shootings of African-American men. And I talked about the importance of staying open and talking. Because I think we have two choices here. We can draw the lines and say this is a fight and we must win. Or we can say maybe those lines could be blurred and people could come together. And I just have too much faith in compassion and in human beings to say that we've gotten to that point where it has to be a fight, where those lines are drawn. And it's taken me a while to get here, to really focus my attention on bridging those gaps between oneself and those one disagrees with, as opposed to defeating those that one disagrees with. And of course, you don't do this in a naive or foolish way. If someone is engaging in truly harmful behavior, you don't say, oh, let me understand your harmful behavior while you continue to do it. You try to stop them, of course. And we also need to recognize that there are times when people actually know what the truth is and they simply disregard it willfully in order to achieve some kind of result. And I think that really happens quite a lot. Willful denial of reality seems to be becoming more and more popular. And it's a crazy thing. And simply lying about stuff and getting away with it seems to be happening more and more on the national scene. And I think the press is getting a little better about not accepting that and calling people out. And that may be one really good thing that's coming out of this particular election season. But still, when it comes to talking to others, friends and family, those who disagree with us, we can strive to maintain an openness because it's there in truly listening, I think, that right action and respect for the mystery come together. Coming to this place where you are willing to hold up your own beliefs to questioning is going to make you stronger, not weaker. You can deeply hold your values and act for them and still know that you may make mistakes regarding the details. You can still acknowledge that you have something to learn, and there's no contradiction there. So I hope I've answered the question I posed at the beginning. I'm not sure. The more I approach this question, the more difficult it seems. How can we engage in right action in the midst of not knowing? I think we can be committed to right action in an unwavering way, and we can act. We cannot be paralyzed by the fact that we have this knowledge that we have this capacity for delusion. We must act. But when we act, we must do so so carefully with an understanding of the limits of human knowledge, a willingness to question our own beliefs, a willingness to fully understand the beliefs of others, and a willingness to find some common ground. And it's not so easy. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to extinguish them. So we just need to keep at it. That's all. We just need to keep at it. With the support of each other, of course. And that's what I have to say about this. So if anyone would like to comment, I would be really interested in what you have to say. Or if anyone has a question for me. Yes, Pamela.
Can I have a question for you? Because I was in a diner yesterday. I just thank you for this talk. I just think this is a hard time. I'm trying to speak up. I'm trying not to be rude. I'm trying not to be deluded. It's all really hard. I think this is very hard.
Yes.
It's calling us to do this. So I was in a store yesterday in Edina, and there was a mom, a Mexican mom, or I don't know if she's Mexican, but she spoke Spanish, and his darling three little boys. And there was a woman, a white woman who came up and said to the sweet little boy, "Go back to Mexico."
You're kidding. That's really shocking. That's awful.
Really, you know, I mean, here we are in Minnesota, and or the woman in Applebee's, remember that smell, that woman in the face with her beer mug because she wasn't speaking English.
Mm-hmm.
So I did not know what to say.
Right.
I said nothing to that woman, and I would have liked to have said something to that woman. So that's my question to you.
Yeah. Yeah. So in case anyone couldn't hear that question, it was about an incident where someone said to a small child, "Go back to Mexico." And it was an inquiry about what to do in a situation like that. And of course, it depends on the dynamics of the individual situation. I don't know who else was there or what it was like or the setting. So I'm not going to come up with a simple answer as to what the best thing to say would be. But I do think incidents like that where people are clearly saying something racist, that is not a time for us to say, well, you know, to remain silent because we want to understand. And I'm not criticizing you for not speaking up, you understand. I don't know what I would have done in the same situation. But I think even though we have this great capacity for delusion and not knowing, and we respect the mystery, some things are simply wrong, and I think it's clear to us, and we have these really deeply held beliefs about these things, and we should be really clear about these things. And I think when there's really bad, harmful behavior like that, especially to a child, that, you know, it's appropriate to be clear about that, to take some kind of action. And again, I'm not going to say exactly what that might be. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I need a answer. Yes.
You need what? You need what?
I said I needed an answer there.
Oh, okay.
That you know, it's hard to know what to say. I ended up going over to them. They weren't very far away. There wasn't anybody else around. And I went over to them and said, because it was unbelievable to me. And I said, did she say something mean to you? And the little boy, the mom didn't speak very good English. And so the little boy answered for her, the oldest little boy. And she was maybe 7 or something. And two other littler ones. And he said, yes. And I said, you are a beautiful little boy. And I am so sorry that she said that. I'm just so sorry. I'm sorry, I said to the mother.
Yeah.
I was able to do that, but I would like to be able to say something to the woman.
Yeah. So you did do something. You spoke to the child and to the child's mother. And I'm really glad you did that, because that's part of that experience too. The experience they had, and when they remember that, won't just be the negative part. It'll be the part where you came over and said something very positive as well. Would anyone else like to hazard an opinion here? Yes, please.
So when situations like that happen, I'm just thinking here, there are only two kinds of people in the world, and we are only one in this room. If we think about it, there is only one of us here in the world. So there are two kinds of people. People who are awake, people who are asleep. If someone is asleep, what kind of behavior are they going to display? And if we understand what being asleep means, we know people are in their head completely, and they do not make sense, that they are not aware, there is only one of us. So this family, they probably will go through a lot of more stuff like this that we can witness or not witness, but things change. So it's going to be down, it's going to be up, and then maybe we'll wake up, maybe they will see this white woman again in 20 years telling something like that. They are going to be awake and they are going to feel compassion. And they are going to say, she suffered. Anyone who is asleep is suffering, it doesn't happen. Anyone who is awake has been able to stop suffering. And that is just wonderful, because we don't know if the Mexican woman is awake. And the little kid is a little kid, he will grow up. So I think that's very important to remember in any situation. She's asleep. Why would she act in a different way? Mom is completely asleep. He's completely in his head. So compassion is a very important thing in this world, crazy world we live in. Two kinds of people. Where are you? And where are they? Who is suffering here and who is not? That's the only difference. Who suffers and who don't? Regardless of the money, regardless of the color of the skin, or whatever we are saying.
Okay. Thank you. Yes?
I think all I'm going to say is walk up to the woman and say, what a pathetic world you live in. Please go back to it.
Okay. Yeah, anyone else? Jeff?
Ted, thank you for your talk.
Yeah.
I have a problem. I think Zen practice, Zen Buddhism, tends to emphasize individual right action when they talk about right action. But there's collective right action also. The freedom rides in the South are an example of that. The citizens at the lunch counter, Gandhi's salt march, the mass nonviolent demonstrations that brought down Milosevic in Serbia are further examples. We need to look for forms of collective right action that can be disruptive but are nonviolent, and therefore within the Buddhist tradition. And so I appreciate Pamela's confusion and pain in that situation. I've been in those sorts of situations as well, but I believe it is through collective action that we can begin to reshape the world and prevent these kinds of things from happening in the first place.
I agree with you completely. I believe in collective action. When I talk about right action, I'm not talking just about individual responses. I guess everyone has individual circumstances and responses they must make on a day-to-day basis, and that's an important part of what we do. But to really get things done, I agree, collective action. There's a wonderful chapter in Tigan Dan Layton's book about bodhisattvas, where he talks about Samantabhadra, one of the great bodhisattvas, as being sort of the bodhisattva of collective action. And the exemplars of that are people like Gandhi. And I think people together are just so much more incredibly effective than people alone. So thanks for mentioning that. I think this person back here first. Yes.
I think it's important to not stick with reality, with a fact. You know, there's a tendency in Buddhism to become very conceptual and wide in terms of the use of the words that get used. So we've got thrown these words like love and compassion around, and it's sometimes really difficult, as you said in your talk, it's not always easy to know what is a compassionate action. You know, this is an example that was given there by that lady in the store is an example of a real situation and something that needed to be, that was, she was rightly questioning what was the right action there, and she found a way to do that. And there are many ways of right action, depending on where one's at. But, you know, when we talk about collective action, it always starts with somebody saying, this isn't okay, and I want to do something that is coming from a place of love and compassion. And there has to be a focal point for that to start. So essentially, we are called individually, to examine what is going on in our lives and what things are not consistent with our values that are given to us throughout these practices. And it's from that place that we can find the courage, or possibly find the courage, or not find the courage, or the energy to move forward into something that's really important to the world. And you know, there's many ways in which that looks at. You can look at that. I'm right now looking at the function of money in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And having too much money, I'm wanting to know for myself, okay, what's the right action? And it's this delusional thing is really a big issue. I mean, because here are all these causes and conditions and experiences in life that led me to believe that, you know, at all costs avoid paying taxes. Right? How many of us have that?
Mm.
When you think about that, that's a really big question mark as to how do you deal with that on an individual basis. But that's just my example. It's just an example for me right now in my life that I can go to the. I can. Well, you know. Anyway, I don't want to go into that. But the bottom line is, but I think this is a personal. This is an introspective understanding of where I come from around something as simple as having too much money.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Jim.
Well, this is kind of a little bit. The discussion went into sort of the direction of right action, and when I look at your notes, I'm seeing right action as well as not knowing or mystical. It seems to me that that Buddhism is kind of separated into two schools, sort of the Eightfold Path people, the right action, and I've heard right over the years described as in different ways of right,
mm-hmm.
just right or right being suggested to do this way or and that. But is there something? So it seems like you have one school that is pushing right, and then you have one school that's pushing the dependent origination, where everything arises and there's no absolutes, and so in that frame there's no right or wrong. Is there something in the ancient texts? Are there commentaries that discuss this and also discuss the idea of collective action? Or is this something new to Buddhism in the last 50 years?
I think I don't know.
Because there are two distinct
ways
of viewing the Buddhist text. I don't
see that contradiction where on the one hand we have right action and on the other hand we have sort of everything is relative and therefore there is no right or wrong. I think that there's really just one way of looking at things, and it's what I tried to present in my talk today by talking about, or at least touching upon, how everything is interdependent. There are not so many absolutes. It is hard to know what the important things are. It is hard not to be deluded, and yet we still must act. And I think reconciling those two things is maybe the essential question of Buddhism that we need to keep working on and keep holding. I don't really see it as two separate views.
Well, I understand that. I was listening intently to your talk. But is there, and you do deal with legal issues, is there a precedent in Buddhism for something like that, for collective action, for the ultimate, for taking action on right, taking political action on right action?
Well, you can look at the Buddha's life, and there were a number of things he did. I think he stopped a war on one occasion. He made a very deliberate contact with a person who was considered untouchable. He admitted women to the Sangha after some pressure. So he did take a lot of important actions in the world to bring about social change. We can look at that. So, okay, just one more, Jason. I think we'll have to make it kind of quick. No pun intended.
Let's see. I appreciate the talk and so many of the comments. Really latched on to the being asleep or awake. However, I would challenge the correlation of those with suffering or not. Because I certainly feel if coming here is opening up to awakening, the start of that has a lot of suffering. I think when you unveil suffering,
it's suffering coffee because I don't suffer any longer.
Really cool. Keep working at it. is what you're saying. So maybe more just suggestion of right action is if the instinct is this is not right or that this woman yelling is suffering, but like maybe just keeping those words in mind, right and suffering, and just somehow blurting them out. And but that's a hard situation to immediately interject in, but I don't know what I would do either. But clearly she's suffering in some way and deluded, and that's really hard to get someone to see, but somehow planting a seed of that seems.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. It's kind of a question of skillful means. How do you deal with someone coming from a certain place? And it's something that I hope we'll have a lot more conversations about. And right now, I think we need to go to our announcements.